papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. Or I meet politicians.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in the news media these days and give you some insight into newsroom decision-making with some veteran journalists. I'm Rex Smith, a columnist for the Upstate American and commentator here on WAMC. I'm formerly editor of the Times Union. Let me introduce you to my colleagues. Judy Patrick is here, vice president for editorial development of the New York Press Association, formerly editor of the Gazette in Schenectady.
Hello. Glad to be here.
It is great to have you around, of course, as always. Barbara Lombardo is now adjunct professor of journalism at UAlbany, formerly editor of the Saratogian and executive editor of the Record in Troy.
Happy to be here.
It is always good to have these conversations. And Andrew Waite, columnist for the Daily Gazette. The Daily Gazette of Schenectady, I should say. And you're the guy who's got a new, well, not really a new boss. Tell us what's going on at the Gazette.
Yeah, the Lind-Hume family has decided that they are selling to the Gazette's current publisher, John DeAugustine. He's been there a little more than a decade, and his family has been involved with operations, heavily involved with operations of the Gazette for that time. The Lind-Humes did not have an obvious successor in their family, and they sold it to the DeAugustine family. And so now it will still be a family-owned publication, as it has been for almost 130 years, but it will be the DeAugustine family instead of the Lind-Hume family.
Yeah, it's quite something. You don't hear much of that these days, or at least in the past 40 years in America, you haven't heard much of that. Family-owned newspapers tend to sell to chains. And I was the editor of The Record years ago when there was a significant effort by that company, who eventually Barbara worked for when she was editing The Record and The Saratoga. And they tried to buy The Gazette. I think there's been a lot of interest in it, right?
Yes, and I remember that there were other parties who had tried to locally buy the Saratogian way back when, but instead it went to corporate hands.
Corporate hands, now actually held by a
hedge fund.
An evil hedge fund.
I think that's part of the title. So, Andrew, I noticed in the last few years that the Gazette has done a lot of expansion of its properties, media properties that it owns.
Buying additional newspapers, you mean?
Newspapers, mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, and a lot of that is DeAugustine's doing. We took on the Recorder in Amsterdam, the Leader Herald in Fulton County. We're expanding south now with the Register Star. And yeah, I think it's really an effort to try to take those subscribers and just add them to the Gazette family of newspaper subscribers, and time will tell if it works.
Yeah, well, they sort of have a territory that is not currently served extensively by other larger media companies.
I think the Gazette is trying to win from Schenectady County west to Utica. And I think doing a fairly good job, you still have to be able to staff those western papers. And it's a struggle to get people who want to live and work out there. And that's going to be part of the challenge. But I think if you can do it, there is an opportunity to make money and do quality work out there. So again, we'll see.
So, Judy, as former editor of the paper, did you see this kind of thing happening?
Oh, no, it was a shock. Because I worked for the Hume family for 40 years. I grew up at that newspaper. Sometimes I come across as too idealistic when it comes to journalism, but it's because I was raised in that environment where the news was paramount, that local news was especially important, that you needed to serve the community, and I got that from the Hume family. So the idea that there's change, I guess at my age, I have to accept change, and change can be good. Things cannot always stay the same. But I mean, I just want to recognize the contribution the Humes have made to the Schenectady region. I mean, we greatly expanded our coverage. I mean, you saw this too, Rexby. We had bureaus everywhere. We had reporters everywhere. Local news was our bread and butter. We considered ourselves the paper of record. We covered every zoning, planning, village, town, county committee meeting there was out there. And I mean, it was a different time, a different generation, on a different business climate for local newspapers. But even going forward, I mean, as we talk about the future of local newspapers, I think family ownership is key to the survival of local papers, because families do something that corporate owners cannot do. They can care about the community. And I'm looking forward to see what happens with the paper that I dearly love going forward.
I think it's really notable when you say family ownership. One of the things that is different, and by the way, I worked for the Hearst family.
Yes.
It's a big family, but one of the things about family ownership is they tend to be less greedy. And hedge funds, of course, have only responsibility to the financial backers. And so I guess there's some understanding of that. But when you say the D'Agostin family, I think you mean John and his wife. They met at the Times Union. John was the circulation manager of the Times Union 20 years ago. And so I think one of the things about a family is that they're willing to support themselves with it, but they're not trying to enrich shareholders. And it makes a great difference in being willing to take a profit margin that isn't astronomical, which is what chains came to demand of their properties. And second, they don't necessarily have territorial ambitions that require great indebtedness. I worry about that a little bit when you see these additional papers that, frankly, nobody else bought that have now been acquired by the Gazette. And I worry that there is a debt load that may inhibit the journalism that is the ambition of your newsroom to undertake. But who knows what that might be? And I have to think that John's a smart manager and he'll figure that out.
Yeah, and when you're selling your building, as the Gazette is in talks of doing, that points to the need for revenue and just speaks to where the money, the cash flow is. And that is a worrying sign, I think, but it could also be smart. It's all about survival. And if you can survive to 2025, get some state money, which is going to be coming in, maybe you can fill these newsrooms back up and all of a sudden the quality goes up and that increases subscribership. That's an idealistic hope, but we'll see what happens. And it's about surviving the day, I think.
Just explain state money coming in. These are tax breaks for payroll taxes. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So the governor passed this year tax credits that are going to be going to news organizations or newspapers across the state where new hires can be partially funded through state tax credits. And the idea is to help bolster newsrooms that just haven't been able, that have been really laying off staff rather than hiring staff, and change the dynamic on that.
Well, it's sold in lobbying as being for new hires, mm-hmm. but it isn't necessarily so, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of the details are still being sorted out, but exactly right. It was passed as a way to hire new employees, right?
We'll see. It's revolutionary in America if this happens, right? If this goes forward, but it could be hopeful. Anyway, for our listeners who are not in the capital region, you're missing some of the dynamics of this in the terms of the geography. I should say you're missing the details, but you get the dynamics. This is around the country. If there were more properties going into private hands this way or staying in private hands, local journalism might not be in as much peril as it remains.
So interestingly, I'm already getting questions from readers about if you're getting money from the state, are you then going to cover the state less rigorously? Of course, the Gazette has closed its capital bureau, so maybe that's a moot point for the Gazette. But are you then beholden to the people who are providing this money? I don't think that that is a risk as of yet, but of course there would be a line where that would be crossed. I don't think we're close to it with money coming in 2025. But
well, are we beholden to our advertisers because we take money from them? I don't think so.
Right.
Our subscribers also.
Our subscribers?
Right. I think we have an obligation to cover the whole community, not just the people who subscribe to our paper. I think that, I mean, advertisers as well. There are a lot of sources of revenue for any news operation. And what journalists have to do is just keep focused on where the news is and where the community is and serve those needs. One of the first questions my husband had after the Local Journalism Sustainability Act passed was, does that mean you're going to be beholden to the state? Public radio gets that question all the time. They have dealt with it. It's a minor amount of money, and there are a lot of agencies or businesses that get state tax subsidies, as we've talked about in the past, that don't feel beholden to do service to those agencies.
Yeah, I worry about that less. I don't think that journalists are going to suck up to the state. Is that in exchange for a little bit of a payroll tax relief? But it can make a difference. In some small newsrooms, I think, for example, in Gloversville, there can't be more than maybe four people in the newsroom. I'm imagining that.
That's generous.
I see.
When an owner has multiple properties, there's this economy of scale that you aim for. And that has its pluses and minuses, and it's a real challenge for the publisher, for the owners on down into the newsroom, to figure out how to balance the need to provide local news and news that's of relevance to your specific community, and what things can be so generic that it could be shared. So does somebody in Gloversville care about what's happening in Rotterdam or Amsterdam? And yeah, it's a tough balancing act.
You know, does it make you more inclined to cover the assembly person's press conference or to run their weekly column than it was in the past. I don't know. A lot of papers do that anyway. I think, again, it's going to be a balancing act. And I have asked before, I think we should hold ourselves accountable to how this money gets spent and report back to our readers. We got this much in tax credits, and this is what we did for you in terms of local journalism.
Excellent. So that's interesting news from the local front. And let's just go a little bit further west. For those of you who, again, don't know the geography here, we're going to talk a bit about Syracuse here, a little west of where we are sitting in this studio in upstate New York. The Syracuse School Board Commissioners, we don't call them commissioners here, that's an odd term, are independently elected representatives refusing to take direct questions from reporters. Apparently what's happened is the board has decided that they are not going to take any questions from a TV reporter from what is called CNY Central, which I believe is the NBC affiliate in the Syracuse area. And they are saying, we will direct your news agency to cease reaching out to individual board members, take steps to comply with the district's procedures, and to engage with their press operation. The school district has a $2 million press operation. Is that possible? Am I reading this correctly?
Which was over their budget, right? Wasn't their budget 1.9? But yeah, that's an insane amount of money. I actually think, sadly, this model, it has become fairly common, including districts around here, where you at least have to start with going through the press office. I think that that's fairly common. The difference is not being allowed to reach out. I mean, trying to regulate the way a reporter conducts his or her business, that seems way of an overstep. And then also, it sounds like the press office was non-responsive to these reporters, which if you're going to have a $2 million press office tasked with responding to reporters' questions, they should do it, especially.
You would think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this was couched in legal terms, right? It was a kind of a forbidding, scary.
Yeah. Well, they referred to harassment, which is, you know, a misdemeanor. So if you're going to charge a reporter for that, for making a phone call,
or a citizen. I think the legal term for this is baloney, big time baloney. And this should make the reporters there and in any other community facing this double down on their attempts and their editorial writers on their attempts to hold the individually elected officials accountable. I can understand if you want somebody speaking on what's the position of the school board, for instance, that perhaps it's agreed upon that it's the president of the school board that year who is the spokesperson for those official comments. But each person is elected individually, and they need to be held accountable. Public needs to know where they stand on things. This is frightening.
I think part of this is fear with cancel culture, and especially if you're worried that a camera is going to come and capture a moment that's going to become viral. I'm not at all excusing that on the school commissioner's behalf, but I think that that's part of what this is a reaction to, is everyone is just so afraid of becoming the next viral clip saying something, especially with schools, which are so wrapped up in the culture wars, and you say something offhand or it gets taken out of context, it's one snippet, it ruins your career, not just your, I don't know if this was a volunteer position, but I mean, it could potentially take down your entire career if you'd said something idiotic that was captured on camera and shared online.
But for a reporter, of course, getting the truth of what's going on in a board requires talking to many board members.
Yeah, I think they absolutely should have that right. I just think that that's part of what this is a reaction to, is trying to protect their school board members, which, yeah, again, I think they should be held accountable. These are elected officials, but
I think they also included district officials, or district employees of some sort, where maybe there's a line, you reach the person and they say, I can't speak, and that could be the end of that. Next week, our school board, I believe it's next Tuesday, right?
The 21st, yep.
Elections, as we speak, for school districts all over New York State, and it's important for people to understand who's running and what their positions are on issues more than ever.
You know, this is part of a trend. I mean, we've seen it for years. Elected officials, public officials who are paid, do not reply to reporter questions. This is just the most egregious development in this string of walls that have been erected to prevent reporters from asking questions and getting the answers they need. It really is incredible. I mean, I remember when reporters were blocked from going into Utica City Hall. I mean, these kinds of things have happened. Typically, what will happen is the newspaper will respond by writing editorials. Oftentimes, those walls come down, but sometimes they stay up.
Well, Schenectady County is that way. You need to go through a press office. And I think especially as newsrooms have diminished in staffing, it becomes easier for reporters to just rely on emailed statements. And it's just, okay, we got the county's response to it. And that has been the way it's been functioning. And the county is, of course, all too happy to be able to communicate via written statements. And too often reporters are just willing to accept that as, okay, we got their response and that was it.
Right, yeah. It's the quick and easy way to, quote unquote, tell the story, even though you're not telling the full story.
This is actually where an editor can make a difference. I mean, I certainly have had situations where politicians have said to me, I am not going to speak to your reporter, tell your reporter not to call me anymore. And you say, well, you have a right not to speak to that person, but I'm going to expect her to keep calling you. And if you want to be quoted as saying, I have nothing to say, we'll do that. That's your choice.
And not only an editor, but a publisher of a family-owned publication. I mean, that has a lot of sway, too, within a community. And I know John DeAugustine, for our publisher, is on the phone often with officials and sort of doing those kinds of machinations behind the scene and saying, you got to call back so-and-so. And that is important. Yeah.
Yeah. Sources will often reporter shop. You know, they will reach out to the editor saying, I'm not going to talk to that person anymore. And the editor has to stand up and say, well, I'm not taking the person off the beat. You have to deal with this person. It's crucial that you do that because you can't let someone choose who they talk to.
Yeah, and when those things are raised, I think it's fair internally for the editors to take a look at what the complaint is about. So you want to make sure that you are taking into consideration, does your staff person have a problem with their demeanor or their way they're approaching the person or how they're asking their questions, whatever. And then hopefully you're finding that they're doing the right thing, then you must stand by them.
I think that's a great point, Barbara, that sometimes editors reflexively stand up for their reporters, but I think we need to listen to complaints and hear out what the concerns are and whether there are legitimate reasons for politicians to be upset or whether it's just thin skin being unhappy about the notion of somebody actually writing about what's going on as opposed to what you want to be telling them.
And with small local newspapers, you're often relying on young, inexperienced green reporters, and there's a lot of turnover. People haven't spent time on the beat. They don't necessarily haven't established those relationships. So I think, yeah, it could be fair for an official to have some qualms with the way that they are being covered. But yeah, important for an editor to be weighing that in a realistic sense and being fair.
From a distance, also, journalism can look better. There was a time many years ago when the business community, and we can be blunt about this, in Glens Falls, New York, called up the Times Union and said, why don't you establish a Times Union edition here because we don't like our local newspaper? Well, you know, the Glens Falls Post-Star was a good local newspaper and did some really strong reporting. And I think they didn't like the fact that they were being held to account for what they were doing and thought that, oh, gee, it'll be much easier if we've got this paper an hour down the road. We obviously didn't move forward with that idea because it's one of those situations where the grass is always greener. It's not as though they were going to get an easier time.
And for Hearst, it wouldn't have been a smart business decision.
Which had a lot more to do with it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith here. That was Barbara Lombardo with Judy Patrick and Andrew Waite, and we're talking about decision-making in local newsrooms. Here's one that actually every journalist in America, one way or another, is weighing, I think, and that is even if you're a local journalist, you run into the divide in national politics and trying to understand how to write about what's true and what is perceived as being damaging and biased on one candidate. Nick Kristof is a thoughtful columnist for the New York Times who, in a Q&A with CNN this week, talked about how the press shouldn't be neutral in covering what he said are the threats to democracy by Donald Trump. And we've talked about this on the program, but it is a very difficult notion if you are covering what's going on in American democracy these days, in America's elections these days, to write about the facts of the matter and not be really ticking off one side that represents about half the country. So what Kristof is saying is you can't give in to that you have to be clear about the threat to democracy that is posed by Donald Trump. But that is hard when half your readers are then going to assume that you're being biased against him.
You can't worry about what the readers are going to assume. You have a responsibility to report the truth fully. And I could give you a non-Trump and Biden example when I read Oliver Darcy's interview with Nick Khrushchev, who I admire tremendously. So then I just looked for something else that was currently in the news. And one of the articles that was in the news was about Florida, Ron DeSantis, eliminating climate change as a priority in Florida.
Cannot legally. Be mentioned in any laws. See, they are actually removing from state laws reference to climate change.
So it's big. So there's a lot of ways that a news entity can report that news. And in the Washington Post, Anna Phillips wrote, Florida will eliminate climate change as a priority in making energy policy decisions, then comma, in the clause that's still part of the lead, despite the threats it faces from powerful hurricanes, extreme heat, and worsening toxic algae blooms. And I'm sure the reporter and the editors are thinking about how do you report this story where you're trying to get essential information in the lead. If they wanted to say it differently, they could say Florida will eliminate climate change as a priority, you know, responding to the unsubstantiated belief in climate change, something about to ensure that people will have all the oil they need for their whatever it might be. They could phrase it in a different way that would be more a different spin on the news. So that's a small example where a choice of phrasing helps to relay the truth.
You know, I spent a lot of years as a journalist being worried about people thinking I was biased or unfair. And I realize now that I really should have instead have been worried about being unclear. One of the basic things I talk about when I deal with interns, because we have a college internship program, is clear writing. Get to the point. Do not use jargon. Do not dance around an issue. Be clear. You've got to be pretty certain of where the truth lies, but you need to be clear. The other thing is, I think democracy as a value is something we in the newspaper industry or the media should embrace. I'm in favor of literacy. That's another one of my big issues, and democracy. I don't go very many other places, but I think this is something we as an industry should support.
Well, Rex, when you say it's hard to do, so I tend to be in favor of being repetitive in some of the reporting, which can be a problem. And so, say, every time I would mention in a story, if I had to mention that Mitch McConnell was supporting the Republican nominee, then I'd want my next clause to say, despite calling him an insurrection, you know, and using the quote mark, you know, an insurrectionist in relation to the, and claiming the, you know, the election was rigged and all that, that you have to keep that top of mind.
So, Andrew, you have a little more flexibility because you're a columnist, but you're not free. I always try to make this distinction when people ask about columnists. You're not free to make up information or to just present what's biased. It is actually more in the juxtaposition of facts that you have your power, right?
Yeah, exactly. It has to be based on facts. I think thoroughness, which is and clarity, that is the way to combat the bias. I mean, part of it, if people are willing to believe a lie, then there's really nothing you can do to sway that person's opinion. But the more thorough you can be in your reporting and in your telling of whatever the issue is that you're working on, that is the way to begin to change minds. The problem is the stuff that does well, especially online, is the thinner, harder, quick takes, and that's where the eyeballs are, and fewer people are willing to read thorough reporting, I think, and especially online, and that's what the metrics tell us. And so it is a tough balance of how do you attract people to what you're doing, but then get them to stay and actually get them to pay attention.
You know, I think people don't understand, if they haven't practiced journalism, how much nuance it goes into a lot of these decisions. I'm remembering as a beginning reporter, the first time I ever covered a fatal fire, I wrote in my story that neighbors reported that a woman and her child had died in this fire, and neighbors reported seeing the father of the household leaving moments before flames were licking out the windows.
We're all raising our eyebrows.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Around here, can you believe that? And quite rightly, people suggested how inappropriate this was, that it made it sound as though he was somehow implicated in the fire. It wasn't. Now, it was factual. He had left the home just before the fire broke out. But by the way I wrote it, that was really inappropriate. However, what you're saying here is a great example, Barbara, of putting the facts in the lead that are relevant for consideration and fair.
Was that a teachable moment for your editor as well?
Well, unfortunately, I was the editor. I started my career.
And did you punish yourself?
Yes.
You still have regret. Those kind of things we regret forever.
Yeah. Well, obviously, look at it. I'm thinking of it now.
It was a teachable moment.
It was a teachable moment, almost 50 years later. And it's a good thing to have teachable moments. And I think that as journalists, we're learning all the time. But the advantage of having an editor who will say to you, yeah, that wasn't so good, or have you would wish to have somebody who would have caught that before you put it into print. Which opportunities do not come to people who are live these days? You know, so much of what we do doesn't have the advantage of getting to wait for your story to be written, edited, and published because immediacy is such a higher value now.
Yeah, and Andrew, when you raise the understandable question about, well, when I'm writing or broadcasting, gee, are people going to pay attention? Are they going to listen to it? Are they going to read it? Your bigger question is what you are presenting to them something that is going to help them be informed citizens and take action?
That's it. And that is the last word at this point because we've run out of time.
Wow.
About that. That was Barbara Lombardo, SUNY Adjunct Professor of Journalism. Judy Patrick has been here, Vice President of the New York Press Association. Daily Gazette columnist Andrew Waite, and I'm Rex Smith from the Upstate American. And we are grateful to you for joining us. We are appreciative of our producer, Dave Gustina. And we hope you'll be back again to join us next week for The Media Project.
Mrs. Sadie Smuggery, she wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interest.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Andrew Waite, news columnist for the Daily Gazette. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild.